episode of Pit Lane Parlay.
And welcome to another episode of Pit Lane Parlay. My name is host Mike Jokum. Matt is joining me alongside Mr. Blogger Extraordinaire Mike Knapp. Gentlemen, how are we doing on this lovely, what is it, Wednesday night?
Good. Fantastic.
Well, Mike, thanks for joining. Jess, we miss you and can't wait to see you back next week. Let's dive right into it, guys. It's Toronto week, which is one of my favorite cities on the planet. So I can't wait to get up there tomorrow. And going to be a great weekend. So, but before we discuss Toronto, we have to discuss probably the best part about Toronto, and that's the fact we are going to see Robert Wickens behind a car this weekend. No, not an Indy car, but a Acura NSX with hand controls, similar to what Alex Zanardi used for, why am I drawing a blank, for the Rolex 24 this year. And Wickens will be using it for the parade lap, so pretty cool there. Just a little couple of the notes on that before I get your guys' thoughts. He's got a pretty sweet custom helmet designed by Bell. So great job by Chris Wheeler and the gang at Bell Helmets. His fiance Carly will be in the passenger seat, and she's been pretty cool about documenting his practice laps today and, you know, his whole journey. So great to see there. And everything obviously has been modified and upgraded by their awesome sponsor in Aero Electronics. So just, I mean, I'm going to give my thoughts here briefly and then come back to it. But such an awesome story. So cool to see that. Just watching the practice laps this morning on Instagram, I definitely stopped doing work for a little bit. I don't know what you guys think, but I'm pretty excited by it.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing thing just to see where he came from to where he's gotten to now. I was this afternoon reading a story from the Globe and Mail in Toronto. And if anybody has a chance to check out that story, check it out, because it really gets into a lot of detail, especially just in the aftermath of the crash. And that's one of those cloudy areas that nobody really knows a lot about. Obviously, IndyCar was doing its best to protect him. His family was doing his best to protect him and really control the message, which is obviously understandable. But to really just read what he went through as far as being in the coma and being on so many drugs, and then he was on fentanyl and went off at cold turkey and had to go through the withdrawal. And there were times where he didn't even recognize his fiance because he was so drugged up and in so much pain, and his body was so broken. And just in the matter of 11 months to go from, you know, the edge of death and your body so broken to the point where he's actually able to drive a car with hand controls, you just can't say enough about his attitude and his courage and everything he's put in. He and Carly and everybody involved, what they've all put into to get him to this point.
Yeah, the biggest thing for me, I think the two things I took out of it was, one, just how cool it is for everybody to come together, whether it's Acura, whether it's Aero Electronics, who continue to be one of the best sponsors in IndyCar, Bell Helmets for making that great helmet for him, looks stellar. It's just so cool to see kind of everybody come together to put this together for Wiki, and to see him on the track this weekend is going to be so cool. And then the second part to me is the fact that, you know, Carly will be in the front seat with him. And to me, that's just a tip of the cap to all the support that she's done for him and everything, and being by his side this entire time, which definitely has not been easy for anybody. You know, Robert, Carly, his family, you know, a lot of his close friends, it's just been a difficult, you know, last year basically. And for this, it's definitely a sign of things to come. And hopefully this is just the beginning of a great comeback for Robert. And hopefully we see him on the track one day again.
Yeah, very well said there. Looking forward to it. Can't wait to see him at the track this weekend. And I mean, the car looks pretty slick. And whoever you know, does those spotter guides every weekend at IndyCar, I think Arnie did this week's actually. So shout out to Arnie for actually throwing Wickens in the number 6 Acura NSX in the spotter's guide. A nice little touch like that goes a long way into you know, the overall weekend. So before we get to a quick Toronto preview, I wanted to give a family shout out. Hopefully by the time that my dad is listening to this episode, he's not in the hospital still and he's at home and watching the race this weekend. So we're all thinking of my dad this week and the guy who got me into racing a long time ago. So let's dive into Toronto here, guys. This is one of my favorite tracks and cities. It's a pretty cool place. So a quick review here. Newgarden, Rossi, Pagenaud, Dixon Power make up the top five in the standings. Obviously, Rossi's only 7 points back, all the way back to Power, who's 108 points back. So real quick, before I dive into Toronto, is it a 1-2 race at this point? Or do any of the three, four, and five have a legitimate chance to jump back into the championship standings?
I'm going to go with just Newgarden versus Rossi for the rest of the year, unless Dixon can pull out a magic act and somehow get it within range in Laguna Seca and then pull a Scott Dixon and completely clown everybody.
Whoever is going to make a move has got to start doing it soon. And we're talking about this weekend. If you're, especially if you're talking about Power, he's got to finish on the podium the next two or three races, or he's done. I'm actually, I'm thinking he's gonna sooner or later get it all together, have a good weekend. But yeah, for those guys that are, Dixon likes to talk about that 100-point mark. But those guys, somebody's gonna have to make a run in order to get back into it. And I would call it like a 1-2 race, or maybe a 1-2.5 race, because I'm not ready to write off Simon yet. Because again, if he wins and Rossi and Newgarden have a bad weekend and finish, say, in the 20s, all of a sudden he's, 20 odd points back. So, I think he's still on the cusp of saying, yeah, he's still in it. But yeah, I think unless somebody makes a big move, Newgarden and Rossi are going to separate themselves from the rest of the pack at some point soon.
Fair enough. And just last year, guys, speaking of Wickens, he was on the and Dixon. They were both on the podium last year with Dixon winning, Pagenaud second, and Wickens third. So let's talk the weekend. I think the one thing that's going to help is it's not going to be 97 degrees in Toronto with this. Which I'm very excited about, because last year at the race and the other couple times I've been to Toronto, it's been 95 degrees every year, which I'm glad I'm not bringing a heat wave to Toronto for a change.
No, you're just bringing it to Iowa.
Yeah, I know.
That's going to be fun.
But let's talk the good and the bad predictions. Let's start with who we think might struggle this weekend in Toronto.
And harkening back to Long Beach, I really think Toronto is the kind of track that'll see the guys, who are seeing it for the first or second time. The track's bumpy. In order to move up, it takes a lot of, really ballsy type moves and things like that. And so if you're back in the pack and you don't have a lot of experience at that place, that might lead to, mistakes. But, when you look at Long Beach, Rosenquist was the highest rookie finisher, and he was in 10th place. And then everybody else was way down in the classifications from there. So seeing the similarities, because it's such a physical track and it's so tight and there's not a lot of passing zones. There's not wide areas like you see in St. Pete or even Coda or whatever. It's just going to be tough for those guys.
Kind of like we discussed last week, I think Sage Karam's going to be slow on the speed charts. He does have a glimmer of hope if there's a lot of attrition on the race day. Toronto's tough to predict just because Toronto can be kind of a circus sometimes when it comes to incidents and attrition, crashes, incidents, engine failures, things like that. So struggles might come down to whoever's caught up in an incident or causes an incident, or whoever just has poor mechanical reliability. So with that being said, I'll probably just throw a name out of a hat and say, I thought I was going to think of something a little faster, but I guess not. I'll go with Hunter Ray, because why not?
All right, yeah, he did not have a good race there last year. started sixth and finished 16th. Thank you to racingreference.info for that lovely information. I'm going to go with, well, I can't go with Rene Binder.
You wish he was back.
Yeah.
Wait, that sound you heard was Jess going, who? Miles away.
I need to put that into the soundboard here. And I'll touch on Karam in a minute after he talked to Marshall Pruitt earlier, but man, it's. I think the Dale Coyne cars might be in for it this weekend. They didn't have a good race here last summer. At least Bourdais didn't finish two laps down. I think he was involved in that crazy accident with about 17 cars, midway through the race. Nonetheless, that's my completely unthought out opinion because I did not think out this one in advance. And everybody I would have picked, like Rene Binder, is not racing this year. So moving on, who are our predictions? Who's going to have a great weekend?
I'll be that guy, and I'll just go ahead and flat out say Scott Dixon. Shameless plug, he's got the highest driver rating at Toronto out of anybody who's there this year. And winner last year, done really good a couple of years, actually. 2014, one of those races, he was going to win and then caught on lucky yellow. 17, I think he was taken out by power, quote-unquote taken out by power on the first lap. But that guy is, for some reason, he's got Toronto figured out. It's kind of a risky pick in the fantasy IndyCar world if you are going to pick him because, again, a lot of things go wrong at Toronto. But I'm going to go with the Iceman, Scott Dixon.
I'm going to go with power. You go back to Road America and take away what Rossi did, and power was fantastic. He drove an outstanding race. And like I said, he's got to get motivated and get moving. And, sooner or later, it's going to happen because he's so good and because he's with with Penske, that he will win a race. And I think it's going to be this weekend.
Yeah, totally fair. It's a good thing I didn't pick Will Power because we know what's happened the previous three times this year. I'm sorry, Will and Faux Will. I'm going to go with...
Hi, Faux Will, by the way.
I'm going to go with Zach Veach. Started 22nd, finished 7th last year, which really propelled his kind of second half surge that we talked about so much last year, was the Toronto race. You had a good Detroit weekend. Didn't really have much in Road America, if I'm remembering correctly. And I'm completely drawing a blank on where he finished in Road America right now. But nonetheless, I think we're going to see a strong weekend from Zach Veach. So go a little, I don't know. I'm not going to pick the easy hanging fruit on this one. So Zach, don't let me down on this one. I want to be the right answer here. Moving on, we talked a little bit about Sage Karam last week. We talked, I think one of you guys just touched on him in our who may struggle prediction. And I think if anybody read his chat with Marshall Pruitt, which was on racer.com, I think earlier today, which is Wednesday, and he said, listen, I might be at the bottom of the speed charts on the first practice because I have no prep time, no practice time. I'm sure he's been doing the iRacing, prep to at least, had some sort of, remembrance of the track, because he hasn't raced any street course in 4 years, and he hasn't raced at Toronto, I think, since 2013 or 2014. So, it's been even longer than that. So I don't know if he'll struggle. I think he'll find some speed in the car as the weekend goes on. Obviously, I'm not predicting him to finish on the podium, but I'm pretty pumped for Sage overall. And we will have a special extra episode coming out early next week with a chat with Sage that we will be conducting Friday morning. So guys, I have one final question for you before we move on from our Toronto preview. We've seen the red tires fall off dramatically. It feels like, especially since Detroit, the red tires have had a much shorter shelf life than they have in general, which I don't think is a bad thing. It just, it's pretty noticeable. And, the drivers have all, commented on it at one point or another. Do we think that's going to continue?
Yeah, I think it's going to continue for sure. I kind of like it, you know, especially the track like Road America. It really punished you if you didn't get it right because it's such a long track that you saw the fall off was about 3 to 4 seconds on a lap. And then, you know, Toronto is obviously not as long, so it might not be as dramatic. But, you know, any change in grip level and any change in lap time would be, you know, hugely effective for drivers who conserve their tires better, or if they're on a black tire and the guy in front of them's on reds and they're struggling really bad, it would be something that could make the racing quite exciting, to be honest. And one real quick thing about Sage Karam too is that interview was very insightful about the, you know, the fact where he's owning up and saying, you know, yeah, my times might be that good. So for the first couple of sessions, and it was also cool. He said the same thing he said in our interview when we had with him like a year and a half ago or a year ago, where he said, you know, yeah, I got all these fans that are just in love with me. And then I got some people out there who just can't stand me, but either way you go, I get conversation going. So like I said last week, I'm super pumped to see Karam drive, and I hope he can manage those tires well if they do happen to fall off dramatically.
Yeah. I'll throw in a couple 2 cents about Sage too. He really, and I mean, we talked to him the one time and just kind of watching how he went through May, and I was just really impressed with what he did, you know, just to just work through all those problems and then get himself back get himself into the field. I think it shows a little bit more maturity, and maybe that will lead to good things for him. As far as the Reds, as you know, I just want as much tire degradation as possible, just because we saw it at the end of Road America, where the racing just became insane because you had all these different cars on all these different paces. So the more the tires fall off in a stint, to me, you know, the happier I am.
Yeah, I think that's fair. The racing there was pretty crazy in that kind of 3-4-5-6 battle, or 4-5-6-7 battle, I should say, with Herta and Hinch and whoever else was, you know, back in there. It was pretty cool. And I think it'll definitely, you know, be the same this weekend. I wonder if, because the weather is going to cooperate much more, if it won't have as big enough of an effect. But, you know, we saw a huge effect on the red drop off, you know, in Detroit when it was nice and cool all weekend. And, you know, Road America was not all that hot either. So maybe I am completely wrong there. So, you know, looking forward to Toronto. As I said, if anybody's at the race, please find Mike Knapp and I. And if you buy me poutine, I will give you a shout out on every episode for the rest of eternity. I'm easy to bribe on this one. I love all the food in Toronto. So let's move on.
Oh, hang on a second. Before we toss it, since you, yeah. I would consider you a Toronto expert now, all 1 year that you've went, do you got any suggestions for fans maybe going for the first time?
Yes, I do. And I've only been to the race there once, but I've been to the city many times. So a little in the city, if you're visiting from out of Toronto, you know, definitely go to Steam Whistle Brewery if you've got the time. It's a really cool place. They do free tours all the time. Wayne Gretzky's restaurant's a pretty good sports bar to, you know, hang out. And they've got stuff, you know, 17 TVs with different games on there. I don't know if the Blue Jays or the Canadian Football League CFL team are home this weekend, but if they are, their sports fans are very passionate. I'm sure you could know that. And lastly, in the fan village or near the fan village at the track, there's about 17 food trucks lined up. And I ate my way through about 3 or 4 of them last year. So, you know, check that out. Honda has a pretty big tent with some simulators in it and some things like that. Toronto Motorsports will have all their t-shirts and diecasts available at the track. So, you know, you get those who are into the diecast and merch game. You know, there's even more available this weekend than normally is. Am I missing anything else? If you don't know what poutine is, it's French fries with cheese and gravy. Obviously, that's right up our alley. I ate about 6 pounds of it in Montreal a couple weekends ago when I was on vacation up there. So Toronto is such a nice city, and the weather's looking beautiful this weekend. So stay outside and explore the city. And I will hopefully see some of you guys out around town after the days are done at the track.
Yeah, two quick factoids. First of all, the Blue Jays are playing in some stupid team from the Bronx this weekend. So they will not be in Toronto.
That was mean.
I'm sorry about that. Second of all, this isn't the stump the host question for the evening because that's going to Nap later, but not trying to steal your thunder here, Nap. But what is the, or I don't even know if this is the record, but Joey Chestnut just won the hot dog eating contest here for the 4th of July. He also holds quite the, we'll say, benchmark for poutine. So either of you two, how many pounds of poutine do you think he ate in 10 minutes?
Dear God, that hot dog eating contest is disgusting. I know this is.
It is. But I can't look away sometimes.
Yeah. Moving on. I'm going to say.
That ended quickly.
I'm getting hungry just thinking about it. 12 pounds of poutine.
Nap?
18.
Nap is closer. It's actually, so if anybody does this to host Mike this weekend, please send me pictures. But the record's actually 25 and a half pounds.
Oh.
Which is the, according to whatever website this is, the equivalent to 6.7 large pepperoni pizzas.
In how much time?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. Oh my gosh.
So if anybody gets host Mike 25 and a half pounds of poutine this weekend, please send us pictures.
Oh my God. I will die.
Isn't that crazy? It's just absurd to think about.
I'll send pictures of Mike laying there in his food coma.
There you go.
It won't be a food coma. I will legitimately.
All right. Anyways. Yeah. There's a, we'll call that the JV stump toast tonight. Moving on a bit of, I want to say sad news, but kind of a bummer news this week was some comments made by Daniel Ricciardo, Formula One driver for Renault. He came out and said that, you know, he's been in, keeping in touch with Marcus Ericsson. Apparently they were in the same event some point recently in America and got to talking to Marcus about how IndyCar was going. And Marcus said that he loved it and that he didn't really have an interest in going back to Formula One. Meanwhile, Ricciardo said that he didn't really have a whole lot of interest in IndyCar because the ovals scared the expletive out of him. And kind of sad because I feel like if there's one Formula One driver that would really excel both socially and just on the track in IndyCar, that would, in my opinion, would be Daniel Ricciardo. So that was kind of a bummer to hear that. I believe that was from AutoGP or one of those European racing magazines that kind of pulled that up for us. But on that note, you know, I've always said that Ricciardo would do well in IndyCar. And he specifically does call out ovals, but for you two, do you think there's any current Formula One drivers that would do very well on ovals if they came over and tried it?
Yes. I think Max Verstappen would excel in IndyCar and ovals. He's got that ballsy personality that you kind of need to have in order to, you know, make the moves necessary to run at those high speeds. So I'm going to go with Verstappen.
Yeah, I agree with that one too. You know, the thing that a lot of these guys could remember is that at some point, ovals scare the expletive out of everybody. So, you know, that's just kind of an acceptable part of the job. But it takes some guys a while to, you know, come over and realize that. But I think Verstappen would probably be the best one.
Well, on top of that, what you're saying is, to me, the best oval drivers end up being the guys who had never tried an oval before they get to either Indy Lights or IndyCar. The two that come to mind immediately, well, one is Will Power, who is garbage on ovals for the longest time, and now he's one of the best on ovals. And I guess I don't know for sure about Scott Dixon. I don't know enough about his leading up to Indy Lights to know if he had a lot of oval experience prior to that. I don't believe he did. I think he won some sort of Formula Ford or Renault or something like that. Something European-ish or maybe in New Zealand. But, you know, those two guys are the best drivers on ovals, in my opinion, at the moment. And they, again, weren't immersed in the ovals until they got here. So, to me, anybody in Formula One can come give it a shot. I would say Kimi Raikkonen, if it was like 7 years ago and he was not kind of getting towards the end of his career. If I didn't have to go with Raikkonen, Hulkenberg seems like the kind of guy who would just get in there and send it and not think things through, but just be really brave about it. He seems like he's one of the more braver Formula One drivers. And One of the guys who says that F1 needs to be quote unquote more dangerous to kind of bring a little bit of the thrill back. So I don't know why I would say Hulkenberg.
That's fair. Let me just jump in with one thing here before I get to the Patreon shout outs. I actually, you know, I like you, Matt, I was disappointed that obviously it doesn't sound like we'll see Ricardo in IndyCar ever, but you know, major respect for him saying, listen, it's cool what Marcus is doing, but I have to admit, I am too scared to do it. You know, props on him for, you know, just being honest and not giving us some, you know, some of these other drivers who say, oh, well, ovals are boring and IndyCar is spec sort of blah, blah, blah answer that makes F1 the elitist attitude it gets a lot of the time. So
for sure.
But yeah, obviously bummed that, you know, I would love to see Ricardo over here and get a chance to talk to him because he's definitely one of the most fun personalities. With that being said, speaking of fun personalities, this week's shout outs go to, man, I don't remember what I did last week, so I'm going to start at the top here. Thank you, Colin Taylor. Thank you to some lady, Darcy Bretz. Never met her before. Don't know if I ever will.
Yeah, she's not coming this weekend, unfortunately.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, she's work stuff.
Oh, well, Darcy, I hope you have a wonderful work stuff weekend. David Lighting, it was good seeing you last weekend or a couple weekends ago. Thank you to our buddy George, Jake Neely, Jason Camps. Good luck this weekend. He's doing some SCCA racing in Indy. Carrie Chim, Lyndall McMurphy, Mark Van Niekerk, who I'm very excited to get to see this weekend in Toronto. The Stig and Michael Goodyear.
All right, time to stump the host here, Nap. What do you got for us?
Okay, we're talking about IndyCar championships. So, and of course, as we know, Rossi and Newgarden are separated by 7 points in the standings. So, over the last 10 seasons, what's been the average difference spread, whatever you want to call it, the average difference between first in points and second in points over the last 10 years?
Is that at the end of the season?
Yes, at the end of the season.
Oh, boy.
Oh, man. Well, you know, that 1 year Dixon and Montoya were tied, but Dixon had the tiebreaker. It really throws a wrench into my numbers here. And by numbers, I mean complete guess because I can't do math.
Mike's feverishly Googling and adding at the same time.
I can't do that. My brain would explode. I'm going to say 17 points.
And just to recap everybody, so far tonight, Mike has admitted that his brain is going to explode and that his stomach is going to explode. So we'll see if we can get like a pinky toe or something by the end of the episode here to explode. Point differential, I think it's smaller. I think it is 9.
Actually, it's 32.
Oh, Lord. Where did that go wrong?
Well, but in all fairness, there have been 6 seasons where it's been 18 or fewer.
Oh, dang it. Why was it even closer?
So the big outlier is Pagenaud winning in 16 by 100.
That's right. He had like, what, 70 points or something?
127. Holy, so you throw that one out and it takes it down to 21 points.
Holy Lord, I forgot how good he was that year. Yeah, so that's why he shouldn't be fired, even though I'm the one who's kind of leading that campaign.
What's amazing, when you look at you stretch those 32 points over 16, 17 races, it's like 2 points a race. You know, I mean, that's just the competition level and what you have to do to get to the top of the standings is amazing.
All of that without stages and playoffs and overtime and DRS and all that good stuff. Who would have thought?
Imagine that.
That's amazing. I would have thought that racing would just kind of take its own course and do that kind of thing, except for 2016 outlier. Moving on. Apparently, so for those who don't know, Iowa has been around the IndyCar schedule since 2007, and it's always been sponsored by the Iowa Corn Growers up until this last year. They were no longer going to be the sponsor this coming season, so last year was when James Hinchcliffe won. Robin Miller of Racer Mag has been coming out twice now. He said kind of sneakily in an article about attendance and ovals versus road courses and things like that, and how attendance is never going to be what it was once in the day, that Iowa had a title sponsor, which is kind of news to everybody, because right now it's listed as some sort of generic NTNT IndyCar Grand Prix of Iowa or something kind of generic like that. And then today in the Miller's mailbag, he said again that Iowa has a title sponsor, but again, there was no mention of who exactly that was or where he's getting that information from or anything like that. So I'm just going to, I don't know if we need to get our thoughts on that per se. So I'm just going to throw it out there. Of you two, just name a company. Who do you, any ideas, stabs in the dark, bold predictions? Who on earth do you think this mystery title sponsor for Iowa is?
Rich Energy.
Oh, stop. That's for later in the episode.
I wish you were Fong's Pizza.
What is that?
Fong's is, it's a Chinese themed pizza place in downtown Des Moines.
Oh, okay. So it is like of the area, and it's not.
Yeah,
like something,
yeah. It's
Texas or something.
If you're going to Iowa for the race and you're in Des Moines, go to Fong's Pizza, because they actually make these pizza rolls like egg rolls, and they're freaking amazing.
Well, I guess if we're going that route, if you're coming from my neck of the woods down south to Iowa, there's a restaurant in Ames called Boulder's Tap House. There's a bunch of them in Minnesota in the more like bigger rural cities, and it is my absolute favorite restaurant. I think I'm planning on getting it about 5 times when I drive through Ames. So I guess hopefully the Boulder's Tap House Grand Prix of Iowa, but I guess the more realistic guess for me would have been Casey's, maybe, question mark.
You know who I hope it's not?
What's wrong with Casey's?
No, I'm cool with Casey's, but you know who I hope it's not is Come and Go.
Oh, sorry. I thought you said I hope it's not Casey's.
No, Casey's. They rule.
Oh, Come and Go? Well, yeah. Isn't like, aren't they called something, because in Minnesota they're called Quick Trip.
Yeah.
Aren't they called something different in every state?
Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
Oh, are they? Because I've seen them in, thought I saw them in Iowa, and that's what they call them in Wisconsin. So, you know.
All right. And Mike, you're sticking with Rich Energy?
Us, yeah. Midwesterners.
My prediction is Rich Energy, which we will talk about later in the episode, with their CEO's Viking beard and standard energy drink combination. But we'll save that for later on. Moving on, first of 3 fan questions we'll get to before we wrap things up for the night. This one from Stephen A. Clark, who you can find on Twitter at SVNClark. So thanks, Stephen, for submitting the question. Do you think IndyCar should explore new front wing materials like steel or some sort of bumper system to allow for more aggressive racing? Interesting idea. No. I'll turn it over to you guys before I jump in with my thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I get where he's coming from for sure, because you see, well, first of all, my sentiment with the front wings now is that they didn't change the end planes this offseason like I thought they would to make drafting a little better. But as far as the material itself, I see where they're coming from, because it's pretty fragile. But I don't know if steel would be the answer. I'm not smart enough to know what the answer would be for like an alternative to carbon fiber, but I think there's a lot of positives to what we have now to change it, other than the fact that it's super fragile. But it's almost like a good thing, because then it punishes drivers for making mistakes. For the bumpers, no, absolutely not. I don't want to see bumpers ever back again, because the ones they used in the old model didn't even work as far as preventing cars from launching on each other. They ended up just becoming a integral part of the downforce and aerodynamics of the car, which to me was not the purpose of them at all. So I personally would not like to see bumpers back ever again.
No, I agree. I don't want to see those either. And the idea of noses made of steel or even chrome, you know, so you can throw the chrome horn on people. But the idea is great, because, you know, to have the cars hold up a little bit better. But, you know, of course, the concern would be in a crash. You know, the great thing about carbon fiber is it just kind of blows up everywhere. But with steel, you're looking at some really big pieces flying around, and there's really nothing you can do about it. So
that's a good point.
So, you know, that I think from that standpoint, it would kind of be a little scary.
Yeah, I agree with the, you know, everything you guys said. It's an interesting idea, but I think the, you know, the front wing this year with its minimal parts has really allowed for aggressive racing, and you know, without, you know, causing aero bits and kits to go flying everywhere. You know, like they did in that first race, what was that, 2015 or 2016? So great question, Stephen. I am all for, you know, maybe a stronger front wing material if they keep the lightness of it. I don't know. Like Matt said, I'm not smart enough to figure out what that is. If it's some sort of special carbon fiber, we'll call it, but very good question.
Yeah, we got another one here. This one is from Patreon member Matthew Grunholds. I think I should start a campaign for him to get him into like Skip Barber or something. He'd be just fantastic. For those who don't know, he's like one of the best go-karters I've ever seen. His Twitter handle is just his name, Matthew Grunholds. He wants to know what, from our opinions, what makes for a good road course or a good oval? And he, you know, kind of attacks onto that the cars and aero kits can make races better, but what makes the tracks good on their own?
Ooh. Sorry, I got excited. You know, some of my, you know, I'm going to start with the road course. Of course, you know, one of my favorites is Toronto, because there's no room for error. It's edge of your seat every lap, tons of action. In terms of, you know, a natural road course where there's a lot of elevation change, there's long straightaways, there's tight braking turns, you know, a little bit of everything, where it's you know, where it's tough to set up your car for an entire track, I think is what makes a good road. I mean, I guess you could say that for ovals too, but so I'm going to generalize my answer here. Any track that makes it tough to set up for the entire length of the circuit is going to make the racing better, because you're going to have five guys believe it's better to focus on this, five guys that believe it's better to focus on that, and et cetera, et cetera.
I'd say with a road course or a street car course is something that would challenge every aspect of it, would be a, you know, challenge in order to, you know, with braking and long straightaways and tighter turns, faster turns. Yeah, and that's why I like Road America so much, is I think, you know, the whole point of racing is we, you know, get kind of lost in the entertainment portion of it. But the whole part is it's still a competition, and it's still to identify who the best driver is on a particular day. And the more you can challenge the drivers, and the more you make them reach into that toolbox for their skill sets, is to me is better, because the better drivers rise to the top. And you can really see that was evident, like at Road America. You look at the top 3, 4, 5 drivers, and they're the best guys in the series. So, you know, something that challenges them in every aspect and is what makes a good road course for me.
Can I just be generic and say Road America? Is that too?
Nope, that's totally fair.
Well, just like tracks like that where it's so fast, yet little to no runoffs, 2 to 3 really good passing zones, while a really good rhythm section that makes, you know, like Mike was saying, just the setup of the car makes that so much more difficult. If the whole road course was just insanely fast, that'd be one thing, but you got to get that rhythm section right to really get a complete lap. So I would say, you know, kind of those road courses with multiple good passing zones, little to no runoff, and just the elevation and just the flow of it is just spectacular. So any track that has good flow. As far as ovals, that's tough. You know, Indianapolis is obviously the track that puts in the best races every year. So to go outside the box, I don't know if you guys remember the old Homestead layout.
Yes.
In 96 and 97, where it was basically actually just kind of like a mini Indianapolis. It was a 1.5 mile, I don't know what you call it, rectangle, with 2 short chutes, 4 distinct turns, and 2 straightaways. And while the second groove was obviously worse, it wasn't impossible to drive in the second groove, and it really made passing very calculated and very intricate. And for some reason, I don't know why, I just really liked watching those 2 years. And then from then on, it went to a flat kind of oval that we would see kind of like a New Hampshire, except longer. And then it got banking in 2004 or something, which made it that much worse, in my opinion. But
it ruined the racetrack. Let's just call it what it is.
Yeah. And so to me, there's, I don't know why one groove ovals are kind of cool if, because it just makes things a little more tricky as long as they can get enough momentum to pass leading into a corner. So avoiding something like a Phoenix for the last couple of years with the arrow kits, that kind of sucked, but anything where it's one groove oval that can create some good passing.
Yep. I concur with that.
One thing I would say for an oval would be, I don't particularly like Pocono just given what's happened there, you know, in recent years and everything. Although I think it was built for IndyCar and it is, without its scariness, a great IndyCar track, but just one where there's different banking and, you know, different degrees of banking and in the corners and things like that, just to make setup that much more difficult. You know, I mean, Indy, even though everything's banked the same, we all know this, that Indy, you know, all the corners have their own personality. And it's like, if you could design a track like that to where, you know, an oval or each segment of it has its own personality, that's what would make great racing.
Yeah, that's, you know, throwback to our Pocono trivia question from last year. So I think that was one of our trivia questions around Pocono was, what are each of the turns modeled off of? We won't bother going through that right now, but I will bring that up as Stump the Host again, because I'm sure both Matt and Jess have forgotten the correct answer for that one. Yes, because I gave it away, and now they have time to research it. So I'll have to come up with something better for Pocono this year. Moving on to our last fan question before we get to everybody's favorite segment. Another Patreon edition, Michael Goodyear, or Goodyear as it's properly pronounced, M. Goodyear 007 on Twitter. What full season rookie of the year winner became the biggest flop in IndyCar? So Matt was kind enough to compile a large list for us. So I will turn it over to either of you guys if we want to give you know, just a couple of answers here and get your thoughts.
Matt?
I don't want to steal everybody's answer. I'm trying to pick two. And to me, like, it's hard to say a driver was a bust if they never really got a chance to prove themselves, per se, if that makes sense. So the one that stands out to me, just because I'm kind of more of a buff with the last 20 years or so, is Kosuke Matsuro was pretty awful. That guy crashed way more than he should have. And to be honest, I think his rookie of the year was just because there wasn't that many rookies that year. The other one that kind of stood out to me, I would go as far as to say that based on what he did in Indy Lights, again, kind of sticking to more last decade or so, you know, Alex Lloyd never really got a fair shake in IndyCar based on what he did in Indy Lights. I mean, he got kind of bogged down at Dale Coyne Racing, and Milka Duno was his teammate one year, and James Jakes, who just had a brutal 2011, was his teammate the next year when he shared a ride with Bourdais. To me, it was a mix of he didn't do a whole lot outside of one race at Indianapolis, coupled with the fact that, you know, he was with Dale Coyne Racing, and it kind of really honestly probably prevented him from going places per se. So I thought we, back in the day, I thought we were going to see a lot out of Lloyd, and it just never panned out, unfortunately.
I think that's some good answers there.
I'll pass. Only because the list is so long, and actually, I kind of want to pass because my picks are, one of my picks might be a current driver. And so, you know, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go there. So,
all right, Mike is going to
decline. So that's my answer.
This is our first decline of ever. actually, this is episode number 100, right on the dot. All right, fine. I'll jump in. I'm going to go with two here. The first one, it's not really fair because he didn't really have much of a career to begin with, but Scott Harrington won the Rookie of the Year award in 1999, driving for Harrington Motorsports. He didn't even race in all 15 races that year. He was in 11 of the 15, had a 1/5 place finish, a couple 6th place finishes, didn't even qualify at Indy. And then after his Rookie of the Year, he attempted to qualify in won two more Indy 500s and did not qualify in either of them. And in his career, he tried to qualify for seven Indy 500s and qualified once.
Boy. So,
that's a pretty big flop. Let me see here. I'm going to pick one more that's, you know, will kind of stand out in people's memory. Man, this is a tough one. I'm going to go with, as much as I respect him, Tristan Vautier. You know, one rookie of the year, and I don't know if he just never got a fair shake or, you know, just never really seemed to put it together after his rookie of the year. You know, he filled in, what was that, last year at Texas or the year before? I think it was 2 years ago when, God, who was it? Somebody was injured. Who did he fill in for, guys? Can anybody remember?
Which year are you talking?
Tristan Vautier in 2000.
Oh, was it Bourdais 2017?
Yep, that's it.
Yeah.
Finished. So he's got, let's see here, 3 years of IndyCar total. And yeah, he won Rookie of the Year, even though he finished in 20th for the season. I'm assuming he was probably the only rookie that year. But really, after his rookie year, that was the only full season he got. He did about 8 races 2 years later, you know, filling in for, in 2015, filling in, I believe, 2015, I think he was, you know, Carlos Huertas' fill-in for a while, and then obviously, you know, filled in for Bourdais for one race. But disappointing to see how his career kind of fizzled out pretty quickly there. So I guess with that, you know, great question, by the way, Mike. The list is very long that Matt put together for us. And
yeah, like we were talking before the show, there's definitely some studs in there too, for sure. A bunch of champions.
Yeah, there's, you know, we go from Scott Harrington we go from Scott Harrington to, you know, a couple down is Dan Weldon, a couple down is Danica Patrick, a couple more down is Ryan Hunter Ray, and so on and so forth. And,
or like the cart years starting in 93, then the 93 through 96 rookie years were all champions in Mansell, Villeneuve, DeFerrin, and Zanardi. It's a pretty good list.
Yeah.
Well, and even going the 10 years before that was when I started getting into the racing with, you know, Ray Hall, Teo Fabi, Roberto Guerrero, Ari Leyendijk. And, you know, those guys all had really, really good careers. So, you know, and that was what was interesting is Ray Hall was a lot like a guy like Wickens. I think Ray Hall was like in his late 20s by the time he got to IndyCar. So, you know, to finally caught that break. But of course, back then, guys really didn't get their break till a later age. But yeah, Ray Hall, comparatively to now, got a really late start and definitely made the most of the, you know, 10-15 years that he did end up having in IndyCar.
Very well said. With that, guys, it's everybody's favorite time with our new lovely introduction jingle.
And now it's time for Pit Lane Parlay's Pitfalls of the Week.
And guys, I'm going to start it out this week because I'm really excited. Rich Energy. The mysterious Rich Energy. That's sold nowhere. And whose Twitter has provided us endless amounts of entertainment. Whenever. Announced on Twitter today. Which seems quite unprofessional to me. That it was terminating its sponsorship contract with the Haas Formula One team, citing poor performance. Wow, I can't even say that. And also claiming that the politics and PC attitude of F1 is inhibiting its business. All right, I'm going to dissect this for a second here, gentlemen. Citing poor performance. Okay, Haas hasn't had a good year. I can't argue that one, but. I mean, that's pretty rough to openly say. You know, if you want to say that behind the scenes, fine. But writing that publicly on Twitter, well, I mean, we're not surprised. It's Rich Energy. The second part, I can't argue again. Politics and PC attitude of F1. I mean, it is, like we said, elitist. But the laughable part is inhibiting its business, to which I want to know what business. You can't buy it anywhere online. I saw one person who got retweeted by Rich Energy with a case of it, which was probably provided or you know, provided by them or photoshopped or something. And there's been all these Photoshop photos of Rich Energy cans in Monaco and all these places that look totally fake. So Mr. Viking Beard CEO, man, I hope Rich Energy doesn't go away. You know, like I said, I hope they sponsor Iowa. I would be more than glad to be sponsored by Rich Energy here for the podcast. We could really have some fun with that, but I'm pretty sure after following them, they probably wouldn't be too interested in sponsoring us. On that note, Matt, I will turn it over to you.
Well, my favorite thing about it is the conspiracy theory that Rich Energy is actually just some marketing ploy by Red Bull.
Oh, I love when people say it's hilarious.
That would be the most ingenious thing ever, too. That is definitely illegal. We need our legal expert, Jess, to confirm that. But
yeah, Jess, if you listen, can you please confirm or deny that that is illegal or legal?
My pitfall, of course, being related to NASCAR, is to NASCAR themselves. And what happened was the NASCAR, I don't know if it was NASCAR themselves or if it was Fox, do this thing called Radioactive, where they basically show fans at home in video clips of radio messages heard in a race from NASCAR drivers and their teams and whatnot. And most of the time, they're filled with just expletive riddled tirades. And with this one, they posted like a 50-second clip of what some of the drivers are saying in Daytona. It's just kind of a quick little glimpse into what the full episode is going to look like. And so there's a clip in there of Ryan Blaney saying something using an expletive, we'll say. And Blaney replied to the tweet saying, "Y'all should stop making stuff up. I never said an explicit word. Can't just put bleeps in whenever you want to make it more exciting." That, to me, is kind of par for the course for NASCAR, just kind of making things look more exciting than it actually is. Or if he's saying something completely innocent, we just add an expletive beep in there, that'll make it sound cooler. And to be honest, it kind of makes me sad because it makes me think that they do that to all their videos, because some of them can be kind of funny given the context. And now I'm just going to distrust it from now on, which makes me kind of sad. Yep. That and Rich Energy no longer sponsoring F1 makes me kind of sad. It's sad pitfall week, to be honest.
It is.
F1 comes to NASCAR, how much fun that would be. It would be like pitfall heaven.
But
it reminds me of, I don't know if it was on America's Funniest Home Videos or YouTube, but I think it was Jimmy Kimmel who does unnecessary bleeps that make it seem like it's like really bad, but it's actually just a harmless sentence. It's out there. I don't know what it's called. I'm going to call it harmless bleeps. But I feel like NASCAR just stole that idea. And yeah, it's just, I mean, I love the fact that Ryan Blaney called them out.
Right. And there's probably someone in there like, "My 6-year-old Jimmy was listening to this on Twitter and you said a bad word," and he's like coming up and like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." But the fact that somebody was probably grilling him for it is kind of funny.
Well, you know, as Brian Franz calls it, that's quintessential NASCAR. So
on that note, Mr. Knapp, you can wrap it up with our final pitfall of the week.
I'm pitfalling NASCAR too. I mean, that whatever they put on Sunday was just an absolute farce. And it's just kind of becoming par for the course for plate races and, you know, a lot of wrecks, a lot of no-name winners. You know, winning a race just is a matter of not wrecking out of it, to me, just isn't racing, you know? And the funny thing is how as time goes on, all these teams are having budget issues. You know, we're not getting the sponsorship dollars, or we're falling short on our budgets. We're doing this. But at the beginning of the year, you know you're going to blow a 7-figure hole into your budget from crashing cars at plate tracks. And to me, it's just that whole concept. Now, I went and I went to both Daytona races in 2013. And when there isn't a big one, it's kind of a guilty pleasure that it's fun to watch. It is fun to watch in person. But just what it's become with crashes and red flags and stages and, you know, we've got to do this and then we've got to throw yellows and we got to have competition cautions. It's become a farce. So that's my pitfall. I mean, it's just what that was, whatever they tried to put on over the weekend was a complete embarrassment.
Yeah, you know what's funny about Justin Haley winning is his team is also a NASCAR sports management agent company. If you're wondering why that's confusing, please go to AutoNation and read Matt Weaver's articles. I'll tweet them out from my personal account. Matt's an awesome writer and really kind of dives deep into the why on the business side this is a conflict of interest that NASCAR needs to do something about. Really interesting article. That's worth checking out there. So with that, guys, we have wrapped up episode number 100.
Woo!
Toronto is this weekend. Obviously, we'll have the Harding Steinbrenner episode. And like I mentioned, Sage Karam, and maybe one more special episode to release either over the course of the weekend or early the following week. Everybody enjoy Toronto, whether you're there or watching it on TV, and definitely come find us if you're at the track. I will save the typical sign-off for Jess since she is not here, and just sign it off by simply saying, I hope everybody enjoys Toronto.
Here is the RaceCast weather forecast for Honda Indy Toronto. I'm meteorologist Doug Schneider. A cold front is expected to move through the Toronto area late in the day on Saturday. Ahead of this front, scattered showers are expected with an isolated thunderstorm also possible. The chance of seeing rain at the track is only about 30%, but if a shower does occur, I don't expect it will be very heavy or last for very long, so any impacts on the racing should be low. The most likely time for a shower to occur at the track Saturday will be between 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. Most of Saturday will be partly cloudy with high temperatures in the lower 80s Fahrenheit or upper 20s Celsius for our Canadian listeners. Behind the front, drier and slightly cooler air will build into the area Sunday, providing a beautiful day for racing. It'll be mostly sunny, winds will be from the north at 5 to 10 miles an hour, and the high temperature will be in the upper 70s or mid-20s Celsius. For the most up-to-date forecast, visit racecastweather.com and follow RacecastWX on Twitter.